have the agreement of the committee?
Have that available for everybody as soon as possible.
I'll give you a copy of that.
No, Rick, Bob, you know what you can say?
Let's see the finished product.
I'll bet you it's 3-1 right now that you oppose it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
In these areas, when you commented and described the Department of Law, is there any coordination of an administration view through the new OMB process so that we know that, for example, that the Department of Health and Social Services, which has a role here, concurs with you or not?
I can't answer you generally, Senator. I can answer you on this bill, and the answer to that is yes, because I personally have met with Division of Corrections and Social Services, and they do strongly support this bill. We suggest, yes. They don't want these kids mixed in with our population. They do want them treated as adults. They're the ones that have to deal with these people in the block, and they're the ones pulling their hair out saying we can't treat these kids.
Do I have to ask you each time whether this is the holistic view of the Sheffield administration or of the Department of Law?
You shouldn't have to, but out of an abundance of caution, I can try to let you know if there is
interdisciplinary role.
Thank you.
That's what vanilla is, and we'll get you nowhere, Joe.
Okay. Anybody?
Is there a schedule for this committee on this Friday, Mr. Chairman?
This Friday? Not that I know of. You have mine.
I had mine going to Anchorage.
On your own time and dollar?
Yep.
I move that he be excused.
He's
too tough for me anyhow. It's getting out of now.
Of course, we can always pass something out while he's gone.
49.
If there's no objection from the chair, I would like to excuse that.
We excuse from now on. Word your request, right, Chris? No other. Now, you see how that gives us something to think about. See how he said they're thinking about it, Bob?
I think about everything. One of my problems.
What do we have Wednesday?
We'll figure out something.
Okay. Have the opportunity to examine themselves as to factors that might impact that. I think in many cases that this would encourage them to rely on their own desires rather than allow somebody with some detachment and training in the area to examine it to determine whether or not, in fact, there is probable cause. I believe that in my practice over 9 or 10 years, I've only seen one or two cases of any significance which have resulted in dismissal from areas that would be remedied by this particular bill. I think that the harm that is perceived is grossly overstated, and I think that the dangers, both in undoing convictions that might result from this bill and to an erosion of the constitutional rights, are substantial. I would urge the committee to do further research, and particularly if a constitutional amendment is viewed as being necessary in this case by the joint resolution, that we have an opportunity to fully research this area, and I certainly would like to review the briefs in Illinois v. Gates and some other materials, and would be willing to forward any additional thoughts in writing to the committee as I more clearly formulate them. Thank you.
Oh, that would be appreciated, Mr. Bryson. Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions from the committee, and so we'll move to Fairbanks. And the witness remaining there is Lynette Clark. Are you ready to testify, ma'am?
Yes, sir.
Please identify yourself and proceed.
Clark. I'm a resident of Fox, Alaska. When I first heard of Senate Bill 49, I'd like to make a few comments first on the two bills, the joint resolution and Senate Bill 49, and then just some personal comments on police force and use and abuse of constitutional rights present date, and what I feel will happen if these exclusionary rule changes will be made within our current government system. Senate Bill 49, in the first paragraph, the when in good faith section, when in good faith search only results in a technical violation. The semantics in this are overwhelming. Technical violation is a description of a violation, and a violation of the constitutional rights of an individual is a violation, technical or not. In paragraph A of section 1, I understand that a criminal element should be brought to justice. But what frightens me with this exclusionary rule is some of the semantics in the bill, such as good faith. We give good faith to the police officer with section 1, article 14 of the Alaska State Constitution. I'm concerned from one point of view. When I came to this state in 1974, my reasons for leaving the state of Illinois, city of Chicago, was because at that point the city was enforcing and endorsing a no-knock search warrant. And the city being one level of government that you would have to fight all the way up to state and then Supreme Court, federal, it was overwhelming. And I bent for liberty and headed for Alaska.
This lady wrote a letter for did you get a copy of it?
In section B, that goes on to...
Wait, because the police...
I believe it would be paragraph 1, based on
police
the
search warrant, they searched her home,
detached
her cooperation,
magistrate or judge, which warrants
had
free from obvious defects.
Cars came there in the police van, and they were looking for a specific thing.
They're kind of acting like that now.
She said she looked in the van, and there was a painting.
To give you an example, if I may,
said that they found a painting in her house. That's
in August of this last year, my home and property were served with a search warrant. The papers, as required by the existing right to privacy and illegal search and seizure, Article 1, Section 14, were filled out correctly. The oaths and affirmations were intact. The place and the items were correctly described, and it was also signed by a judge here in Fairbanks, who made the specification from the evidence list given to him by the police that the entrance to our home was only to search for a well-described oil painting. When the police arrived with three marked squad cars, two unmarked for both of my driveways, and one trooper truck to haul items seen, my husband and I cooperated. We took the officers through the outbuildings on our property and finally to look for the painting into our home. The painting was not found until the two troopers doing the search. My husband and myself were again outside our home signing papers and getting receipts from the police for items that were located. I looked at the police truck that had been brought in earlier, and the painting was in the back of the truck. It was brought by the officers to our property. They gained access to our home. And when they returned to their offices with their paperwork and their evidence, they had the ability to show that they were right to have that warrant and be in my home because they had found the painting they wanted and had led the judge to believe it was there. This, to me, is an abuse of the law as it exists now, and it's done easily. It was done with oaths and affirmations. It was done in compliance with what we have as our rules. I'm quite frightened what will happen because there's been two classifications made. There's law-abiding citizens and there's criminal citizens. Well, I want to see justice and the criminal element taken from our society and our neighborhood. But they are still citizens, and they still have constitutional rights. And if this line of demarcation is drawn, what's going to happen to the law-abiding citizens? Just in an investigation level, so they, as meaning police, could find evidence. The rule is definite. It says, shall not be violated. And it goes on to say that to give the enforcement level of government, law enforcement, a way to achieve access to these levels that are honest and just and oaths and affirmation. The police chief, Oslinger, I believe was his name, made the comment that judges simply won't accept the signatures of police officers. They'll have to prove it. When my home was served with a warrant and evidence was brought to my property too, so it would look when they returned to town, they gave the judge a list of evidence. And they made their oaths and affirmations. Our good faith is given to the police force.
I don't understand that.
And I think our good faith is given to them for police officers. I'm afraid they will turn into a police force. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Is there any other witnesses who want to testify around the state at the various locations?
This is the moderator, Ketchikan. I have a gentleman who would like to testify.
Thank you. If you would come forward and identify yourself, please.
My name is Dennis McCarty. I'm an attorney in civil practice in Ketchikan. For your information, there are several other persons that wish to speak after me here in Ketchikan. I've been practicing law since October of 1974, and that practice has been exclusively in civil practice, with the exception of having had a public defender conflict contract for 1 year, which expired last year. I think probably since the expiration of that contract, my practice has been more oriented towards representing victims in crimes than defendants. So I feel that to a large extent I don't come with a particular bias, but also mention that at least early on in my career with involvement with the law, I spent a year and a half as a military policeman in Anchorage, and a great deal of that time was spent as a guard in the stockade at Fort Richardson. So I think I've seen to some extent both sides of the fence. The initial comment I would make is that there seems to be a philosophy or opinion of many people that the exclusionary rule or the constitutional amendments we have, commonly called the Bill of Rights, are for the benefit of criminals, to get them off from something which they've done wrong, or as a corollary, that to some extent is for the benefit of the attorneys who represent them so that they can come out with a good job or possibly earn more in the way of fees. That's not the interpretation that I place on the Bill of Rights, and I think that that's is not a correct one for anyone to have. Those provisions are for the protection of rights of the common citizen. I think that it is important to look to the number of instances where the exclusionary rule or the other rights that have been developed in criminal practice come to play. And I think, although I have no personal knowledge of the statistics, the numbers I've heard from other people in conversations concur with what several other persons have said, that the percentage you're looking at of cases which are disposed of because of all the evidence that was improperly obtained is very small. But to use a phrase, it's a squeaky wheel that gets the lubricant, and it's a sensational case that gets all the publicity and immediately gets a reaction. I think we have to avoid a situation where we are reacting to an immediate situation rather than looking at the overall problem. I think one of the concerns that we have to have is in looking at the exclusionary rule or looking at the law of search and seizure, we already have numerous exceptions which do not require a warrant or have other reasons to allow stop of a person or obtaining evidence of various sorts, but without even requiring probable cause. We are looking at the unusual situation where we're starting to get into a realm of, gee, what did the officer think? What did he want to do? I think that to me, that is really the crux of the question. At present, as best we try to operate on an objective standard. What would a reasonable person do given the circumstances at hand? That's the purpose of having a judge who is to be contacted to obtain a search warrant. You have a supposedly impartial person sitting there, hearing the facts, and then determining whether there's sufficient cause to justify the intrusion into a person's life. Do you have a problem in allowing a person who has a particular frame of mind to make decisions which, to a large extent, determine how that person can perform his or her own job? You wind up with a person who has the desire to try and obtain certain evidence. That's the function that the police officers are given. And they are also given the function of determining whether they have sufficient reason to act in the way they wish to act. To some extent, you're putting the hens under the guardianship of the fox who determines whether or not it's really proper for him to go into the hen house. I think given that frame of mind, there's at least a tendency or the possibility of making the improper decision. That's, I think, the real problem we get into here of looking at the police officers who have the already specified intent of trying to detect crime, of trying to obtain evidence to justify bringing charges and to obtain a conviction, at the same time are being asked to sit back and supposedly impartially judge themselves while in the heat of the moment they're trying to do various operations. I think that one of the comments I've heard that the civil remedy is the proper one rather than to suppress the evidence really is not realistic. Frankly, in most instances you're going to be looking at of the suppression of evidence, I think you will often find that the people the police are in contact with are not the nicest individuals. If you go to the Supreme Court decisions, the more famous ones of Escobedo, Miranda, Gideon, you find that those individuals had lengthy criminal records, frequently wound up in serious criminal trouble after those famous Supreme Court decisions came down. The problem is that those people still have constitutional rights to which they're entitled, and the general principle is one that applies to the whole of the population, not just to that one specific instance where you're saying, I had a specific purpose, this is a police officer speaking, that is, and they were thwarted in obtaining that goal. I really think that if you're speaking of a civil remedy, that really doesn't work all that well. If you have somebody who comes into court and is, in effect, his testimony against that of a police officer. The police officer is a trained witness. Usually they're very good at testifying and presenting the facts. They're going to look good, as opposed to a criminal on the other side, or I should say alleged criminal, coming in, who frequently is not nearly as well versed in the mechanics of the courtroom and in presenting his or her version of the facts. And if you're in the courtroom and a jury is looking there, the chance of obtaining a civil verdict that justifies that remedies intrusion just is not realistic. I would mention that my representation here is on behalf of the Ketchikan Bar Association. I did not receive notice of my nomination until early this morning, so I really have not had a great deal of opportunity to prepare any comments. I would concur in the comments of a number of the other attorneys who have spoken. I think Mr. Feldman hit a number of very key points. As I say, I think the real key, in my opinion, is the problem of substituting what we consider to be an objective standard and then going to a subjective standard of determining what was the purpose, what was the basis for the activity. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witness and the members of the committee? Seeing none, per the instructions of the chair, we're going to have to end this teleconference at this time. We have other bills which we have to take up today. If there are other people out there who wish to testify, they could either submit their remarks in writing to us, or if they want to, they could get in touch with us and we can possibly have another teleconference down the road. But in any event, we do have to proceed with other committee business, so this is the Senate Judiciary Committee signing off at this time.
We have Senate Bill 24 that I want the committee to look at. There's a committee subcommittee that's been proposed. I can't remember your name.
Gail
My apologies. I had a memory blank there.
That's fine, Senator. It's not that simple of a name, anyway. I'd like to just explain to the committee basically what the bill does, and then if there are any questions, I'll try to answer them. I was here at the time that this committee considered the Senate Bill 24 the first time around. There was teleconference testimony, I'm sure you recall, and I testified, among others. I indicated that I felt that the conduct of a police officer was adequately covered by the current laws, and it seemed to me that the concern of the committee was that people were not being treated seriously enough by the courts. In other words, when they were being prosecuted, they weren't receiving sentences that were severe enough to indicate, in the opinion of the committee, the severity of the conduct. And I based it on the fact that the officers who testified in favor of 24, original version, had indicated that all of the people who had assaulted them had in fact been prosecuted, but had been prosecuted as misdemeanors and ended up with perhaps not long enough sentences. So what we did at the Department of Law in an attempt to address this problem without unintentionally lowering the penalty for assaulting an officer by drawing a specific section that applied only to officers is to suggest amendments to the presumptive sentencing scheme. The proposed amendments that you have in front of you in the committee substitute form would add the language as underlined if it's a Class A felony offense, that is assault that causes serious physical injury or is used as a dangerous instrument, it's an A felony, the person would be subject to a presumptive term of 7 years, even upon the first offense. Now, the judge, of course, has the power to find aggravating or mitigating factors, as in any presumptive sentence. If he found mitigating, this could possibly go down to 3.5. It could go up to a maximum of 20 years. So you can certainly take it up again further if the conduct was particularly serious.
This is the second degree felony?
No, sir, this is first degree.
First degree.
First degree. Presumptive sentence of 7 years, first offender. Right. And he has no prior criminal convictions.
Right.
On sections 2 and 3 of the bill, establish a presumptive term for first offense B and C felonies. B is the one under section 2, and then C is the one under section 3. At the present time, senators, there is no presumptive term for first offenders under any section of the code for B or C felonies. There is a presumptive term for second and third offenders, but there is no presumptive term for first offenders. This establishes a presumptive term of 2 years for a person who, if it's a B felony, and 1 year if it's a assault on a police officer and it's a C felony. And I would emphasize again that these offenses can be aggravated higher, but the judge cannot, without finding mitigating factors and listing them, cannot go any lower than that. We also imposed a mandatory minimum sentence of 30 days for a misdemeanor. And that, again, due to the broad definition of physical injury, would include stepping on someone's toe, a slap, you know, a punch in the arm, something of that sort. As long as the person understood that the guy he was hitting was a cop or a firefighter or whatever, they would be subject to this mandatory minimum, which the court could not suspend. And I would just, for the committee's information, there it continues to be in the code a aggravating factor of intentionally directing the conduct at a peace officer. So, although you couldn't aggravate a sentence using that aggravating term if you've already given them a presumptive based on it, in other words, you can't count that conduct twice, you can only count it once. If a person has a prior felony conviction and is convicted of a second felony, be that B, C, or A, he or she would be subject to the second offender presumptive term, plus that could be aggravated by the existing aggravating factor of knowing assault upon a peace officer. So if the presumptive term for a second offender, for example, on a B felony is 5 years, that could be aggravated up to 10 by the existence of an aggravating factor assault on a peace officer. I think this addresses the committee chairman's concern that we grade the conduct as to seriousness. I think it addresses the officer's concern that judges aren't given strict enough sentences, and I don't think that it unintentionally lowers the penalties, which was one thing I was concerned about in the prior version. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. I have no questions.
This seems to satisfy at least some of the concerns as to the seriousness of the offense rather than just...
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If you're asking, I don't like the bill.
I know that.
But I'm not going to make the...
Well, a lot of us like police officers and firemen.
I do too, but I don't like the bill.
Do you have any questions?
I'm just, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at... section 1, and trying to determine, you're looking at the statutes, precisely what other conduct is subject to that mandatory 7-year sentence for a first felony conviction. What other?
For example, sir, if someone commits a robbery, if it's an armed robbery, if they had a gun during the commission of it,
okay,
that's 7 years automatically. Or if they cause a serious physical injury, in other words, if the person, you know, loses an eye their organs are injured, that's serious physical injury, that's automatically 7 years. And that's, so really, some real serious assaults on police officers might already be subject to the 7-year sentence. I don't know, it depends on the facts. But certainly this ensures that regardless of the facts, if it's an A felony and if it's against an officer, he gets his 7 years, even if he didn't use a gun, for example, or serious.
Yeah. Okay.
Senator Meisner. What I'm going to do is I'm going to direct the staff to write this up as committee substitute. And we can, again, take it up. At the Monday meeting, we'll take this up for whatever action that the committee determines to take. Also, on Monday, we will take up well,
on Senate Bill 127, relating to unlawful conduct of minors.
No other business comes before the committee. You just have an adjournment to call the chair. Thank you. Senate President is here, and knowing that he is a sponsor of Senate Joint Resolution 1, and knowing his busy schedule, if you'd like to, Mr. President, to come forward, and we're not asking for in-depth philosophical arguments or presentations, just perhaps a short resume of why you would support this bill or this resolution.
Thank you. If I might, I'd more prefer to join you at your table.
You're more than happy to, sir. You stay right here with us.
Thank you.
Meeting.
That
we're glad to run to six.
Thank you. This is the reason that I came. I was to have an opportunity to sit here with you at your table. Others gave testimony.
All right.
I appreciate being able to sit here, and if you take further testimony, I'd be glad to testify on it.
All right, sir. I would ask the committee members to take out their copies, and I'd like to go through this each whereas.
Sure.
There's been a lot of speculation and a lot of rhetoric as to what this resolution will do. I've heard everything from communal bathrooms to lesbianism, homosexuality, all kinds of things, and yet I don't see that in the resolution. And if we go down through each whereas and discuss it, perhaps we'll find out where this takes place. Sure. Line 8, the first whereas talks about the action. The first action in the Alaska Territorial Legislature in 1913 was to give women the right to vote.
I voted for that at that time.
Harold Hansen said he wished he hadn't done.
The second whereas, in 1972, shortly after the Equal Rights Amendment was passed by the United States Congress, Alaska was among the first states to ratify the proposed amendment. I don't see anything.
That was my birthday.
No problem there. Whereas, effective October 14, 1972, the Constitution of the State of Alaska was amended by a vote of the people to include a provision that no person is to be denied the enjoyment of any civil or political right because of sex. No same problem there. Whereas the state constitutional provision guaranteeing the rights of women has been a valuable tool in Alaska and has enhanced the ability of all citizens, not just women, to achieve their full potential. I do have a problem with that. Not with the concept, but the verbiage.
It is clumsy.
Whereas the state constitutional provision guaranteeing the rights of women has already enhanced the ability of all citizens, not just women, to achieve their full potential. I think that reads smoother and says the same thing.
Senator, you are correct. I don't like the state valuable tool.
No.
That has a bad connotation.
So there is a thought. There is.
I've always thought of it as invaluable.
All right, let's get back to the whereases. Whereas negative results predicted by opponents of the state provision guaranteeing the rights of women have not materialized, and the constitutional amendment has not presented any difficulties of any sort. Oh no, no, no! We aren't going to say that. Whereas negative results predicted by opponents of the state provision guaranteeing the rights of women have not materialized, and the 1972 constitutional amendment has not presented difficulties, instead has eliminated some long-standing discriminatory practices against women in our state. And that's what's happened, really.
Well, Mr. Chairman? The amendment of 1972 guarantee the rights of women? Or rather, did it guarantee that civil or political rights should not be abridged on account of sex? I think that's a distinction.
It guaranteed the rights of women, civil or political, and civil and political rights, right.
It also guaranteed the rights of men not to be discriminated against on the basis of their sex.
Well, we aren't talking about men here.
No, but, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
The point is, we did that for both people. And in fact, though, this is a direction for equal rights before in the U.S. Constitution for women. That's the reason we're stating women now in this particular part. It's a directive to equal rights legislation being proposed in the Congress.
Senator?
I don't believe there's any equal rights amendment that says anything about women.
I'm just stating that is the reason that it was written that way. Senator Fisher should be here.
Well, we
prime sponsor.
We're a bit long without Senator Fisher for the moment. What it has done, I believe, has eliminated some long-standing discriminatory practices against women in our state. That's exactly what the 1972 Constitution Amendment did. Didn't remove all of them, but it did remove some of them.
Senator Ray, your verbiage is the better.
All right. The next whereas is the people of the state of Alaska wish to have the Congress again propose an equal rights amendment to the states for their consideration. That seems to be the crux of what we're asking. All the rest is rhetoric. Is this the place where the communal bathrooms come in? Is this what they're afraid of here? Is this the section that they are afraid that the Congress is going to give them something that's unpalatable?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Joseph, I can't speak for the people who have that concern, but from the Hess Committee hearings, I would say that, as you said when you started out, we heard all kinds of what we call a parade of horrors about what's going to happen. And the point is, and this is the point that was made either with the revised language or the original language, that we've had in Alaska for 11 years a provision very comparable. And we haven't had any of those problems. The only potential difference would be in the military service at the federal level and the state level. Otherwise, if those problems would occur at the national level, they should have occurred already here, and they haven't. The Equal Rights Amendment that is in the Congress is the same amendment, though, that we ratified in 1972, the same language.
Was prepared 60 years
ago. Oh, you're talking about the one, yeah. Not our state.
No.
Oh, okay,
no,
I'm sorry.
I'm saying that the pending federal resolution for a submittal to the legislatures is the same one we drafted 60 years ago, which is not changed.
Well, now, let's go through the procedure. Once Congress does this,
it comes back to us
for our consideration.
That's right.
And it would seem to me that at that time, if there are conditions that do not meet the approval of somebody, or that should be the time when the argument concerns, and not this seemed to me that an objection to asking Congress is premature, because we don't know what the Congress is really going to say. But if we believe in the concept that women and men are equal, and it appears that Alaskans do. A recent poll, some 5,000 respondents, the RA was one of the questions, and it was supported, some 80% were in support, against the 20% negative. Can anybody here show me where there's, let's go through with the rest of it here. The resolve clause, be resolved by last state legislative Congress is respectfully requested to again propose an amendment to the United States Constitution guaranteeing equal rights to women. Now, should we be a little more definitive?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
I think we should, if you want to do what apparently these people sponsors want to do, which is they want the Congress to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, the Equal Rights Amendment does not say anywhere in its language that the rights of women are guaranteed. It simply says equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the U.S. or by any state on account of sex. Now, sex is both men and women. If you want to guarantee the equal rights of women, that's fine, but the Equal Rights Amendment does more than that, in my
opinion. So if you're going to ask
why, where does it do that?
Because it guarantees equality of rights for men as well as women. It says that if something is done which is preferential toward women, that it is would be unconstitutional under this language.
Mr. Through the chair, what's your concern? You want to change something? Or?
Well, if the chair asked a question and I was attempting to respond to it, and the question is, are we? What are we asking the Congress to do?
Well, what is your problem, Senator John? What is you think that this in some way abrogates equal rights for men?
No, I don't think it abrogates anything, Mr. Chairman.
What I infer from the Senator's comment is that he, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you will. As Jimmy Carter used to say, you can depend on it. That I think he would be more comfortable if the language was, propose an amendment to the language were, to again propose an amendment to the United States Constitution guaranteeing equal rights regardless of sex. Or to all Americans, regardless of sex.
Well, what to
seem more appropriate, Mr. Chairman.
All right. What you're saying, in essence, is that there is too much mention or dependence on women rather than to have everybody being equal.
Well, there's the word woman is not mentioned in the Equal Rights Amendment. Is that just my point?
Well, if we certainly the problem does arise that women are not equal to men in certain points of law, they are not allowed certain privileges accorded to men at this particular time, privileges such as credit ratings, allowance of credit. There is even proof that equal pay for equal work, which does not exist in certain instances.
Now, if it's the thought that we would ask Congress for an equal rights amendment and base it on men and women being accorded equal opportunities for all these things, then I can understand what you're saying. Is that what you're saying?
Essentially. There's another point, Mr. Chairman, if I might. And that has something to do with the example of homosexuals that you gave. Under the Equal Rights Amendment as proposed, I would think that if a homosexual couple came to Senator Josephson in his private practice of law and requested that he seek an injunction to force the court to marry these people, and they should have all the rights of a married couple, that he would think he probably had a pretty good case in this language.
What are the rights of a married couple?
They are rights of to own property together.
Well, can't they own it singly?
They want to own it together, Senator Ray, because they want to be married. They're of the same sex, and they want to be treated in every respect with regard to retirement benefits, Social Security, the ability to adopt, any number of rights.
Then, in essence, by mentioning particularly the will of the people of Alaska that they want women to have rights equal to men, that would take care of that problem. Otherwise, if you write one that's broad enough to say all people are equal and should be treated equally, then that would be more or less an implement or a tool to enhance the position of those people who are not of the accepted norm. In other words, two women or two men wishing to be married to each other. And if we would say we want everybody to have that equal right, then we should eliminate what the inference toward women or the weight toward women in this. And I don't think that's what we want to do.
Chairman,
sir,
I think that we're being a little too legalistic about this and taking ourselves a little too seriously, if I might. This is a very serious question, but it's an expression of a wish to the Congress to resubmit the ERA. We know what that is. There's a long legislative history about it. Fights about it. There are half the members of the U.S. House want to do it. The California legislature has memorialized the Congress to do that. Other legislatures are considering similar action. And some of us simply want to go on record as having Alaska join that movement. And I think to treat this as if we were passing a statute is not really...
I wanted to accord Senator
Pence... I'm not critical of the chair. I'm simply stating my view.
Sure, the way I read it. Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to make it clear that I'm not. I simply feel that we don't have the draftsmanship technical responsibilities with this resolution, which is an expression of a wish or desire, as we would for amending the statutes.
I'm sure that the Congress of the United States will get the message if we send them something that says equal rights amendments. I'm sure that
I thought that your answer to the Pettijohn statement was definitive, it was correct, met the test. And as much as I would like to fight with you or disclaim you, in this particular case, I'd have to say that you're right on. This is the way it should be worded, and this is the way it should be stated. And it alleviates the question that Senator Pettijohn had.
Well, as long as I have resolved one of your problems, to your benefit, that's another one you owe me.
That's payment of interest on bills due me.
anyway,
fortunately, I'm not an attorney.
To me, what we're trying to do is expressing the desire of the United States Congress to implement another constitutional amendment to guarantee equality, much as we had before. And that's the question whether or not we want to do that. And I, for one, do it.
Am I wrong in that? Is that your assumption is correct or not?
Your assumption is correct as to why you want to do it. You're trying to tell us something that isn't factual. The reason you want to do it is your wife told you to say that. Just like mine and the majority of the guys sitting here.
Senator Markowski and Senator Stevens told me to do it.
The point being is that, you know.
And it wasn't only your wife, it was your daughter told you.
Expression of support for the concept, okay?
Yes. The only corrections that I was suggesting were one in more or less verbiage and did not change the intent or the concept. And it just seemed like it read a little smoother and it took out one or two things that I consider were not good grammar. Is there any other discussion among the members? Are you satisfied, Senator Pettijohn, with your...
Well, I'm satisfied, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to vote against it.
We do that to start with, sir. I wanted to accord you the privilege of the committee.
I appreciate the privilege of the chair.
If there are any public testimony, we would accept public testimony. Now, we're not interested in philosophical arguments. I'm sure that you would insult our intelligence if you could take us in at the long harangue. And you might even hurt yourself in the long run. Be concise, to the point, state why you think that men and women should be equal. If you care, you can say anything you desire, but I mean, don't be laborious, because I think that you could, if you are observant, you will see that the majority of the committee is in your favor. Is there anybody from the public that would like to talk now?
No, sure.
Lillian Redrich, would you come forward, give your name, your affiliation, and give your testimony, please. Sit right there.
Thank you. My name is Lillian Redrich. And I'm the president of the local chapter of the National Organization for Women, Juno Now. We support the passage of this resolution and will work for the ratification of the national amendment when it comes to the state. We appreciate the support of the state for the ERA when it came around the first time and are hoping for the same clear thinking and commitment to equality for all individuals as we try again this year. We believe equality in pay, job opportunities, education, social security and insurance issues will remain elusive without a strong constitutional foundation of the ERA and are committed to its passage as our first priority. I do have some printed information here on some of those issues, which I will submit along with my testimony.
Fine. That'll make fine reading for us.
Thank you.
Just a minute.
Certainly.
Senator Pettijohn, did you have any questions?
I have no questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any other member?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Carla Timponi.
No, thank you, Senator. I noted down that I was just here to observe.
All right. Are there any other members of the public that would like to give testimony on this matter? Is there anything else that the body wishes to... is it your feeling that the chair should again, with the assistance of... staff, et cetera, to work over the language again, not changing the conception of value, but to eliminate, possibly we can eliminate even further the, or we can change it so it make it much easier for Senator Pettijohn to vote for.
Mr. Chairman, again, my interest is making sure that the chair is satisfied with the language and that we can get the matter to a vote. So whatever the procedure is satisfactory to me, the concept that I want to get out.
Is it agreed with the majority of the committee that the chair will again take this back at my subcommittee and possibly reword it, rework it, and bring the result to the committee at a future date?
Subject to our right to comment critically upon the chairman's revised language.
Well, you aren't going to put that in. Yes.
I don't know what the calendaring you have in mind or action is, but I think we have a fly-in of Concerned Women this weekend, and National Women's Week is coming up next week, and I think it would be appropriate if we could, especially since the Congress is sitting now, take action the earliest possible time.
Well, I agree with you, but I still have the responsibility of listening to these women previous to making any determination, and I'm not sure what this fly-in group is going to say, so I'd have to have a meeting while they're here, possibly for them to, again, give a testimony on this and any more features of to enlighten us even further.
Sunday afternoon might be a good time to hear from Mr. Chairman.
I wouldn't want to exclude anybody. We don't have any exclusionary rules in this committee.
Not likely to.
So if there's no other...
Well, then you look forward those people a chance to be heard and
yes.
Hopefully take action.
At the proper time, yes, sir.
That's right.
At the proper time, yes, sir. Is there any other... now, when are they coming here?
This weekend.
And Monday.
I think the 8th or something is the particular day. That's... Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I can speak to that, arriving at noon on Saturday, and they will be here through Monday.
So then we will schedule
legislative reception on Monday evening.
We will reschedule the hearing on SJR1 for Monday at 1:30.
Senator, if I can speak for the group, I'm sure you will find that all the testimony you hear from the feminist fly-in will all be in support of the resolution. I don't think it.
Not that I doubt you, ma'am, but I mean, I hear that there's a vast group of local residents that would like to be heard at the same time that they're here. Now, of course, this is just rumor and conjecture. These things are that I heard, so I can't say that it's true. But I have had a vast amount of correspondence in opposition to the ERA. And hopefully these people. We'll have be able to come on that day or some day to present their side of the case and perhaps point out the portions of this particular resolution that allude to these problems that we were talking about previously about the communal bathrooms and
for unisex bathrooms.
Well, you prefer it than you like, sir.
Oh, okay. You heard news
about it
right
now. No, I'm not going to get an argument with you. Yes, sir.
We can make available to the testimony we receive in the committee, pro and con, on this question. Plan to do that.
All right. Perhaps in a subsequent meeting after Monday, maybe a week or two after Monday.
We'll make it available to you Monday morning.
Oh, okay. If we have the time for it.
We may need to draft an amendment that no new housing can be built without the following conditions: two bathrooms. Okay.
Is there any other business to come? Oh, let's see. We have to go through the scheduling here again. Senator Ziegler, Senate Bill 20.
We're still waiting. I think we managed to submit the gate to all the the magistrate as to whether or not they want to give us a telecom.
Okay.
It would be a lot easier if they did it.
Senator, you can schedule for March 21st, between March 21st and March
21st. It's in that area, right,
John? We can do it while they're at that meeting.
Glad.
All right.
So you're trying to work out which day.
I had thought that perhaps on Friday we would take up Senate Bill 88, authorizing persons 16 years of age or older to be present in certain services and serve alcoholic beverages. There is a problem with the apparent problem with the existing law on every dispensary that is creating a certain amount of acrimony between the law enforcement and those people in the industry. And it appears that it's a statutory flaw that could be possibly corrected with an amendment, a very easy amendment. I've had communications with the liquor board, and they recognize that there is a problem. They've called upon me and talked to me about it. People from the industry have also talked to me about it. And I think that I can fashion an amendment to the existing act that will take care of the problem and make it a permissive thing with the responsibility lying equally upon the licensee and upon the 16-year-old, with the caveat that a licensee may refuse service to anyone in that class. In other words, he is the one that's going to say, I will take the responsibility of allowing them on the premises. I know what my responsibilities are. If there's a problem, I know what the possible things that could happen to me. So if he wants to allow those people on the premises, all right. If he doesn't, he can refuse to allow them in his place of business, and there would be no problem. We're talking about places such as pizza parlors, the Latch Drink, Nancy Derringer's, the airport in Sitka, possibly the airport here. These are all the areas where these problems are attended right now. So we will take that up. Okay. Right, yes, sir.
Of course, we don't know what's going to happen to the drinking law, whether it's going to be raised or not. However, that would be a...
This wouldn't make any difference.
I understand that, but they tie in quite closely. I would hope that if, in fact, legislature does decide to raise the drinking law to 21, that we also look at that particular group of 19 and 20-year-olds should be allowed to go in these places that we're speaking of now.
People have enjoyed a lot of a better right. The privilege.
Right. Well, I think
we're talking, I think.
We're talking about 16-year-olds and up. From 16 on up.
Well, I don't understand what the chairman is saying. I mean, the problem right now, as I understand it, goes between 19 and 21.
No.
But
these are to allow unescorted minors.
Well, we've been through this hassle so many times. Yes, sir. Okay.
But right. I think we've satisfied it if we say, yes, they can do that with the approval of the board, if the board approves the premises. And with the understanding that the licensee knows his responsibility and knows what can happen, and he'll have no recourse other than the legal recourse, or he can say, no, we don't want you in here, and he can refuse the service, which he should be allowed to do anyway at any time. I think that's the answer to it.
Well, Dick and I, sooner or less, and they're thinking about two different things. We're talking about the bill, which will be coming through, like the 19 to 21-year-olds, and I think he feels, as I do, that you can't take a kid who's 20 years old and has had the privilege, for want of a better word, of going into bars and saying, well, now you're all through until you attain your 21st birthday. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's fair. And so I understand the House is wrestling with that problem right now, so they make them look for that bill. I don't know.
So would you, I don't even know if this is proper, grandfather those kids in? Or
I think so.
Of course, well, we're having, you know, I guess we're having a lot of leniency relative to this particular subject, but I wasn't quite on that same wavelength. I was thinking more or less in terms of those people who are 19 and 20 who have been going into a place like Prospector on a date,
sure,
taking
sure.
Their girlfriend in for dinner. This is a special group of people now. I'm saying that if we're going to chop them off the liquor, that's one question. But the other thing is, I think they should be allowed to go at least have the privilege of that restaurant.
Okay, well, I carry it one step further.
You're going one step further, right?
Only if the manager of the restaurant agrees and understands the full responsibility.
Right, I don't argue with that.
Okay, what other? Yes, sir.
He's on proof of that he tried to make a good faith effort to get their ID, you know, and it's protected anyhow, right?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. But the drinking part, I mean, or the incident that comes by when a 16-year-old girl is dancing out on the floor and there's a...
We're still in her last.
There's a 45-year-old logger fresh from the woods, and you know, those things that can happen, see? So he knows what he's up to.
If there's no other business coming before the Judiciary Committee, we